Welcome to the Venutio Novak Report and the American Political Zone. From New York, this is Frank Venutio.
And from Washington, this is Daria Novak.
And Daria, I have a two children and two grandchildren, a remarkable feat for a guy who's only 30 years old, of course.
On which leg?
And they live in the state of Virginia. And recently, gubernatorial candidate Terry McAuliffe made the startling statement that parents should have no say in the education of their children. It is in and of itself a ridiculous statement, but I think, Daria, it is also a sign of the growing arrogance of the left and a complete rejection of the very basic American concept that we are in control of our own lives and our own family.
It's very true. And parents here in Virginia are extremely upset right now. We have groups called Take Back the Schools. We have citizens groups against critical race theory being taught in the schools or being proposed. We have parents that have been told they're not allowed to speak out at Board of Education meetings. There are so many problems with education in Virginia right now that for Terry McAuliffe to come out with a statement that says, I won't let parents into the schools. Parents have no business there. It's just absolutely outrageous. We have in Loudoun County a teacher who was forced to go against his beliefs in how he addressed students by their gender preference or else be fired. When he was first suspended, he took it to court. He actually won in the courts. But the fact is, he should not have had to go to court. He treated all students with respect. It wasn't about that. It was about his personal beliefs, which were challenged by the public school system. If we have Terry McAuliffe back in office in Virginia, the Commonwealth can basically expect to be turned into a communist-style school system where the state controls what the children are fed. And I'm using the word fed because it's not an education, it's an indoctrination here. They'll be indoctrinated for their full time through high school. Frank, I don't know what our country is turning into, but I know Virginia is on the forefront of that movement this week with the debate in which McAuliffe made that statement. I hope that it doesn't start to spread across the country because parents need to be involved. I think since the COVID vaccine, the COVID problem with the Wuhan lab, this whole period and the multitude of issues that we've had related to that, we see that parents are finding out due to those issues what is going on in their kids' classroom because of remote learning. They can see it. There have actually been cases, not just in Virginia, where parents have been told when their students are on remote with their computer in class, parents are not allowed to be in the room. They are not allowed to hear what their children are being taught. You know, Frank, if I had kids still in the public school system, I would be outraged.
You know, there is an air of desperation on the part of the left, on the part of leftist educators, which unfortunately seems to be the majority of people who control schools, not the teachers necessarily, but the people who control schools and school boards, ever since COVID had remote learning. You brought up the point that parents were starting to realize what was being taught during COVID because they were in the room while this was being done remotely. That's when a lot of these school organizations started saying parents can't be in the room. Well, the only reason you hide something is because you don't want someone to know what's going on. You know, there's almost an air of satisfaction, Terry, and I hate to admit this, but you and I for years have been warning about what's going on in the school system. And frankly, to some extent, I don't think that that warning was taken as seriously as it should have been. But when COVID started and parents finally got an earful of what was going on in schools, I think the whole situation changed. Now that it's out in the open, the desperation on the part of those school administrators to get back control and to go back to the propaganda that they were shoving down our kids' throats came to the fore, I think this could be the beginning of the end. If things go right, for the use of education, not for education, but for political propaganda. And it's about time.
And you know, there are a lot of good teachers out there that object to what they're being told they have to teach. We're starting to see teachers now that are objecting in the classroom, in their unions, they're speaking out. I think we have gotten to that tipping point now. And once you've brought this, as you mentioned, out into the open, this is not going to go back into the box. Parents are aware now. There's another interesting fact. It was stated in studies that if we ever got to 11% homeschooling in this country, it would be considered a tipping point for public education. We have now over 11% homeschooled. This is going to impact the public school system. I think it also will be a wake-up call. If their parents are homeschooling, how can they increase their budgets, increase their staff, all the things that the education empire, if you will, in this country wants to have accomplished in the future? You know, they're always trying to hire more assistants, more teaching assistants, you know, whatever other types of bureaucrats within the school system. Well, if there are fewer and fewer kids in the school system, there is going to be less of a need. So I think this is going to dramatically change education.
Just on your point, it certainly in terms of overall hiring in schools, particularly in universities, it was noted in the past couple of years, there's more non-teaching staff in universities than teaching staff. This has become kind of the equivalent of the old political no-show job machine, where to pay off your supporters, you give them no-show jobs. They just get a paycheck and do nothing for it. I think that's kind of what's happening in the educational system in this country. In terms of the curriculum, you know, the desperation following COVID to hide what was going on is so real and so genuine. I think when you brought up the point about a tipping point in homeschooling, things of that sort, there's another tipping point I think we're getting at, where parents are beginning to say, look, public schools simply are not doing their jobs. Little Johnny and little Jane are not reading up to grade level. They're not doing math at grade level. You know, they're simply not becoming competitive in a rural market. So while they're diverting funds and attention away from real education to propaganda, parents are beginning to get the sense that their kids aren't ready for the job world. They're not getting those basic skills they really need. They don't have a good font of knowledge. And the question is arising, particularly, I think, in poorer neighborhoods. If you can't educate my kid correctly in a public school, then give me the money and I'll send him to a private school. I will probably be able to spend less on the private school for my kid than the state is spending in the public schools and get a better education. So it's a combination, I think, of homeschooling and the voucher system, which really is the way this country should go. We tried public education. It worked until the left got a hold of it and stole it from under our nose for propaganda purposes. It's time to junk it and go to a voucher system.
And let's look at what homeschool consists of today versus even a decade ago. Today, so many people are homeschooling that we have small groups, sometimes teachers who were former good public school teachers who have quit and now homeschool several children in their home. We also have homeschool sports teams, homeschool troops to go out with groups to do things. So this is not literally talking about one child isolated in one room on a computer 6 or 8 hours a day. What we're talking about is a different style of teaching. And if you think about it, let's just look at foreign language programs, no matter what the age group in the public school system. If you're putting 30 kids in an hour-long language class, Assuming the teacher never speaks and each student just has a chance to practice speaking, that's only 2 minutes of class time that they speak. Now you take a homeschool program and a kid has the interaction, they can practice speaking, they're going to learn more. We see this across the subject matter. There's more opportunities for repetition, for creativity, for innovation, and parents can cut the school day down to a few hours a day and their child is learning more of the ABCs than they were learning in the public school. So I think there's going to be a reorientation there. When you get to the high school level, for parents that worry about, say, chemistry and mathematics and subjects they may not have felt they're that well schooled in, this is where we're seeing today groups of parents put their kids together in someone's home. So they trade off. Often the child will go to two or three homes during the week with the same group of kids and learn these different subjects. So they're getting a very good level of education. We're also seeing now, and when I say this is the tipping point, that these homeschoolers, which have now grown into the millions in this country, are now going to Ivy League schools. They're going into schools that normally you would have to come out of an academic high school with like a 4.0 grade point average. So this is not saying that it's an inferior education. It's actually in many ways superior to what they're getting in the public system.
Yeah, most of the parents I have spoken to who are doing homeschooling are telling me that their kids, when they wind up taking the state mandated standardized test, are scoring far above the average of the kids in public schools. And that gives you some kind of inkling of how effective the homeschooling is. And you made an important point. One of the fears I think that parents had was that the kids would be isolated, but there are all these groups that they're working with. The kids are not isolated. Dari, let's go to our first guest. Matt Rosenberg is author of the new book, What Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son. I love that title. Our nation's big cities are broken, he writes. Urban progressives' government badly undermines those it claims to lift. Matt Rosenberg, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here.
And it is a great title, a great book. And as a native son of New York, I share your attitude towards what's going on in our cities. Tell us a bit about what motivated you to write the book.
Well, absolutely. I grew up in Chicago. I lived there for 30 years, from 1964 into 1994, from the age of six into my mid-30s. And, I'm looking back at things last year in 2020 after the heinous death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and all of the cities are exploding in chaos and violence, and none more so than my old hometown of Chicago. And my background is in journalism and advocacy. And I said, listen, you know, what I'm seeing on the news is not enough. I've got to go back myself and dig in. So I moved back in and I went deep into the South Side to talk to Black people in their homes and workplaces and hear their thoughts about what's going on and how to dig our way out of this.
You know, I had the opportunity in the South Bronx and in Harlem to attend community meetings. And I can tell you that from my experience, the things the press says the folks in those areas want are not the things that they really are saying. They want better policing. They want more, less political schooling and more realistic schooling. Yet we continue to hear from the major media just the opposite. They give a very politicized view of what's happening. Is that your perspective as well?
It is. It is. When I talked to Black people on the South Side of Chicago last fall after I moved back there, what I heard was they want more police, but they want better police. The two were not mutually exclusive. I heard a lot of support voiced also for charter schools, which the teachers union continues to try and restrict. There's a growth cap right now on charter school seats in Chicago. The mayor, Lori Lightfoot, agreed to it at the insistence of the teachers union. There's even a moratorium on the closure of regular schools that are failing due to under-enrollment or poor academic performance or both. The media is a problem. Little shards of truth do bleed through in some of the reporting. So I think the truth is still out there all in all. I think an even larger problem might be lack of engagement. You know, we've got just one third of our registered voters actually voting in the municipal elections in the city of Chicago. So that's a big problem. There's a way to get at that. They schedule the elections at a very odd time, in odd numbered years, in the early months of the year. They ought to hinge them to the presidential elections when we get 70% voter turnout in Chicago. There's a lot of what I call rigged rules of governance that behind the scenes are helping to make things as bad as they've gotten in Chicago.
There used to be a saying that there is no Republican or Democrat way to pick up the garbage. Have we gotten to a point where our municipal governments are so over-politicized that doing things like picking up the garbage, like providing adequate fire and police protection or education for the kids, is somehow on the back burner to all sorts of ideological political goals?
It feels like we are in that place. We have prosecutors that don't want to prosecute in Chicago. Instead, they want to advance this notion of social justice, which turns quickly into a revolving door policy for criminals. As far as taking care of business in our public schools, there appears to be no real interest in that, despite all the rhetoric to the contrary. The performance data in all major U.S. cities is utterly miserable. You look at the National Assessment for Educational Progress, NAEP, known as the nation's report card. They test fourth and eighth graders for proficiency in math and English. You've got about a one quarter of the student population classified as proficient in Chicago on those tests. The SATs, same thing. Nobody seems to care. It's just a question of mouthing the right words. And too many voters just don't call out the politicians on it. So yeah, I don't think there's a lot of interest in making these cities work anymore. They're more a platform for, some form of social justice and what I call the politics of personal virtue. You know, people want to be on the right side of an issue, the right side as defined by an urban political elite. It's failing to manage these cities.
I want to go back to education for just a moment. I'm wondering if you believe that we need to go down to the preschool level to like a Project Head Start, or where we need to start with the reform with these kids. Where do we lose them along the way? Is it from the very beginning of the system, or is it when they're older and the social studies programs come more into play? What's happening there?
I think it's very salient to focus on the very early years. And I think that's where we're really losing them in many, many cases. There have been in the past things not exactly like Head Start, but of that same general ilk. There was something called the Community Parent Centers CPC program in Chicago. And if you stick with a strong preschool program that demands parents get engaged and involved in things like nightly reading with their young children and provides additional counseling and resources. If you stick with a program like that from pre-K through the third grade, it can make a big difference. They found in longitudinal studies, it can make a big difference over the long haul in terms of educational attainment and even adult income. At one point, they were tracking this program over like 30 years. And so they were not messing around in some of the analyses that occurred. So yeah, absolutely, it starts early. But then too, that takes you back to parenting and the household, right? not just what is the unit of government, namely the public school system, what are they doing? It's a shared responsibility is what I think I'm trying to say. And if just, 10 or 20% of parents are not stepping up, then their kids become disaffected from school and eventually they become troublemakers, quite possibly, and they begin to affect the learning environment. And it gets all tangled up together in a very bad way.
I want to ask you something that's a radical solution, and of course it probably won't work, but do you think there is any way to legally hold a parent responsible for their child's education in the sense that in Connecticut, for instance, in the city of Bridgeport, it's a lower income city. We have many children moving into the kindergarten program that don't know how to hold a crayon. This is not talking about a parent spending a lot of money on a kid. I'm talking about some very basic things like knowing how to count to 10, the colors on a color wheel, things like this. Is there any way to hold a parent accountable for some of the basics?
I sympathize with what you're saying. We see kind of the fruits of essentially parental neglect in many, many ways in our big cities. One is that kind of lack of preparation for schooling and learning. Another way we see it, of course, is in the violence that's perpetrated by children, even, not to mention, young male teens. I think in the end that we have to take it back to the community grassroots level. So for instance, we need more parenting classes. We need nonprofits and churches to really step up. I've seen a lot of that unfolding in Chicago. In the end, it has to be a choice that the parents make, that it's going to be, at the very least, less trouble for them in the end if they do their jobs right from the beginning.
There's a phenomenon that's observable in cities like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, St. Louis. You talk to the people on the community level, neighborhood associations and so forth, and they complain incessantly and correctly that they're not getting the services they want, that the government seems to have other priorities. Yet an election comes and the same elected official that they were complaining about gets reelected. In New York, for example, Mayor de Blasio, who is universally considered a complete failure as a mayor in his first term, was handily reelected. What's going on there?
I think people get locked into a certain habit and way of thinking. They also see, sadly and very wrongly, no real alternative to the Democratic Party. In Chicago now, we've started to see the election to the city council of Democratic Socialists of America, the Bernie Bros and sisters. There are now six of them on the council compared to just one before the last cycle in 2019. I think we have to start with, again, a grassroots message, maybe starting in the church pulpits and the parishes. And among the community organizations that still exist, a grassroots message, first of all, encouraging voter turnout, good old-fashioned voter registration and voter turnout drives, I think, are very important. Then, too, I think you somehow have to rebrand the politics. We need to face it. A Republican is never going to get elected in one of these big cities, if they even allowed for partisan political elections. But I think in Chicago, for example, in some of these other cities, including New York and a bunch of others, what if you had something called the local reform party? Because that's so much what is needed. Progressives have not really brought reform at all, except the very bad kind, like bail reform, which turns into revolving door for violent criminals. So I think you somehow need to rebrand the political effort here and not leave it to the socialists, because that's what we see happening in Chicago.
It has been said that in the city of Chicago, the chances of a young black male being killed by violence are greater than a frontline combat soldier before we withdrew from Afghanistan. Is that not a motivating factor for a whole-scale change in Chicago politics? And yet it doesn't seem to have been.
We are at the beginning of an inflection point, even just in the last 2 to 3 weeks in Chicago, when we all thought it couldn't get worse. It's managed to get worse. All kinds of horrible stories are surfacing every day, including a state's attorney who declined to prosecute shooters involved in an awful, a violent shootout on the streets because they were, quote, mutual combatants, unquote. There's some technicality in state law which permits her to make that decision. People are starting to get fed up. Some important business leaders have spoken out. People are also starting to get fed up with the racial rhetoric. I think we could be at a turning point, and I don't know what you think of Eric Adams. I'm sure there are reasons that he's been criticized by some, but overall, a guy like him represents a wholesale turnabout, I think, and we will see from someone like Bill de Blasio. So part of my thesis is that a city like Chicago needs a new leader. We're going to have a mayoral election again in 2023. We need someone to step forward. A leader of color, I think, is important, but someone who supports police, supports school choice, and who believes in faith and family. And we really need to get back to basics so that more of the city's 1 million households are living with something that we could reasonably call moral authority. I think that's a big piece of the picture here.
You know, I totally agree with you, but one of the questions that comes to my mind is if you look at cities, typically they are progressive Democrat-run cities. If you look at San Francisco, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, places like this, we're seeing that more and more people want to leave the city, work remotely. So those that have the jobs, that have the income, that pay the taxes, that support the infrastructure in these cities, since COVID especially, we're seeing them leave. We're seeing the prices in suburbs and outer suburbs rise dramatically in many parts of the country. Given that money is needed to do the things you're talking about, do you think we can still save our cities? Or are we in some new type of era now where it's not going to be possible?
I think you hone in on an important piece of the puzzle. There's a lot that's going on fiscally here that's very worrisome. I don't know, and I don't think that the tax base will remain for cities to deal with their problems to the extent that you need taxpayer money to do it. And you do, but only to a certain degree. You know, we've got already a staggering public employee pension debt in Chicago and even more at the state of Illinois level. And it's city taxpayers who end up putting most of the bill in the end for the states. $300 billion in public employee pension debt. The city has about $170 million coming due over the next several decades. And taxes keep going up and people keep leaving and they move to Indiana and Utah and Arizona and Texas and Georgia. And you can hardly blame them, especially because more and more remote work is what people are doing. What about the next pandemic? So I think you end up in a place where competition among cities and regions becomes increasingly important, and we have to look at actually doing more with less in Chicago to pay off the pension debt. It's either raise taxes to such a level that the whole place is going to shut down really fast, or stop paying people so much not to work. So if you're going to take care of what's on the horizon in terms of bonded debt for the city, which is a separate matter from public employee pension debt, and take care of the latter, you're going to have to cut back municipal governance greatly. And, you know, how you engineer public approval for that with a status quo that believes in big government, doesn't object to high taxes, and where most people sit on their hands during municipal elections, boy, that's a real tough one. And so if you had the resources, you would probably leave.
I had dinner the other evening with a retired New York State legislator, a Democrat, who said that the difference is not only one of philosophy, a more socialist attitude, but also one of, quite bluntly, the quality of the person themselves. That in the past, someone like a Bill de Blasio or an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez simply would have been laughed out of the room, within the Democratic Party itself. Why have we seen such a true deterioration in the quality of elected officials, particularly at our city government levels?
Maybe it's that more and more of the smart people go to the private sector, not the public sector. I think maybe we have to look also at the university system in our nation, both the public universities and the private universities. The people who are on an education track to go into public service, and that can be from a variety of fields, as you know, whether it's social work or political science or several other things, they're indoctrinated from the get-go, not only in the K-12 system that they've come up through, but particularly in their college years. As you're probably well aware, the humanities have totally turned into a platform for progressive political rhetoric. We're even seeing attempts now to turn the hard sciences into a bully pulpit for progressive values. So I think that the people we end up with now running for office, particularly Democrats, are people who've been heavily schooled and indoctrinated in a whole series of social justice values. And then that becomes really the whole point of their existence in public life.
I'd like to put a quick plug in for my university, Catholic University of America. And this is the reason why, and I think it's important, and I think parents need to hear the statement. My school starts out their classes by saying the professors are there to teach students how to think, not what to think. And I think that's the critical difference. So Catholic University, good job.
I'm with you on that, and that is an absolutely crucial distinction. Couldn't have said it better.
Matt Rosenberg is the author of What Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son, a great book. John, Matt, thanks so much for being on the program. We look forward to our next conversation.
And your readers can find it online only at Amazon at Barnes & Noble. What Next, Chicago?
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
You know, it's fascinating. If we look at the type of elected official, whether it's Lori Lightfoot in Chicago or Bill de Blasio in New York, you just have to wonder, you know, what are people thinking when they elect these folks? Let's go to our next guest, Daria. John Moody is the former executive vice president of Fox News and is the author of a great new book, Of Course They Knew. It's an incredible journalistic revelation of Beijing's complicity in COVID. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You know, I before we get into the meat of the book, I just wanted to postulate one thing to you. Is it possible that the reason that the Trump administration did not take stronger measures against China following COVID was because so much of our medical industry, our pharmaceutical industry, is in China, and we were dependent upon them for the very medicines to treat some of the symptoms of COVID and other diseases as well?
Well, what you said is true. I don't think that was the motivation behind Donald Trump's handling of China. I think that he was determined to bring China to heel in the trade negotiations, in the theft of intellectual property, and in the way it had been handling the rest of the world. It is true that China makes an enormous percentage of the world's medical goods, from complicated formulas right down to the cheap old blue masks that we all have to wear these days. But I don't think that Trump's motivation was a medical one. I think it was far more a geopolitical and economic one.
I was with the State Department during the 1980s and worked the China issues. And I was told literally by the Secretary of State then, and I've said this before on air with Frank, that when I questioned our giving, in essence, or allowing China to have technology stolen from us, that we would be in trouble, especially militarily. I was told by a U.S. Secretary of State, don't worry, there are 3 to 4 generations of military technology behind us. They will never catch up. We've seen China not only catch up today, but in some cases move ahead of where the United States is. How much do we have to worry about the next few years with China, whether it's Central Asia, Taiwan, the Arctic? They seem to be making moves everywhere.
How much available worry space do you have? That's how much we should be worried. Look, if you were there in the 80s, it was probably either Haig or Baker, but you have to remember what we did with something called rare earths. Now, rare yes. earths are 15 elements that are absolutely essential in the production of everything from iPhones to nuclear-tipped missiles. And you really can't, the computer that I'm talking on, the cameras that are you know, taking our picture right now, your air conditioner, your car, probably your phone, are all dependent on rare earths. The United States used to be the leading producer of rare earths. And one day, Deng Xiaoping came to Washington and talked to Bill Clinton and said, we'd really like to get into this rare earth business. And Bill Clinton said, okay, we'll give you all our technology and we'll show you how we do it. And we just trust that you'll, you know, be a fair partner with us on this. China now makes 95% of the world's rare earths. And they have threatened to cut off the supply.
That would be the same Bill Clinton who, of course, authorized the sale of Cray supercomputers to China. Going back to COVID, Darry and I interviewed a physician who actually was in Wuhan before COVID. And her contacts told her that when SARS broke out, when other contagious diseases broke out in China, the first people on scene were who you would expect, key medical personnel. When COVID broke out, she told us, the first people on the scene were military personnel. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, it is. And I think there's very little doubt among honest people that the military went in first and did what military people do. If there were some doctors in there as well, they were probably wearing People's Liberation Army uniforms. But the response of the Chinese government, which is really the same as the Communist Party, was batten this down, get it under control, nail people, literally nail boards across people's houses, doors, so that they cannot leave their abodes. Do not let them out, keep them in there. Some people died from that. And, but as brutal as it is, it was effective in holding down the ultimate effects that COVID had on many other countries. And by the way, we call it COVID because we've been told to call it COVID. We just don't want to offend the Chinese because they don't like it when you call it the Wuhan flu or the China virus.
You know, about a year and a half ago, I wrote an article on Chinese bioweapons. And I happened to have a bit of background in Chinese and was reading something that the Chinese probably didn't want put online, which was an agenda for a conference outside of Beijing on bioweapons. They had generals, they had individuals in the medical industry, and they were talking about the fact that they needed an offensive bioweapons program. Now, this was a conference with people who had been writing papers years before that they were now presenting. This is not something that is new to Wuhan or to the lab that was set up in other labs similar set up in the 2000s. How much do you think we need to worry about China's use of other bioweapons, if you will, to further their own agenda in the world. They don't seem to care much about life.
Same answer, I'm afraid. How much worry space do you have available? Look, they want to. They want to weaponize everything. I saw an article in the Daily Telegraph of London today that said that Wuhan virologists had been working with, get ready now for your worry space, their American colleagues to create a new kind of SARS, COVID-19-2, that did not yet exist, but they were trying to see if they could develop a new one. This is with American aid. Now, do we think that they were doing that for preventative reasons? Why would it be preventative if it doesn't exist right now?
Is there a Fauci implication in all that?
It was his institute that was collaborating.
Yeah. We knew, of course, that it became evident, rather, that the World Health Organization was complicit in covering this up. In the United States, with the possible exception of Fox News, it seems that anyone who used your phrase, which is the correct phrase, the Wuhan flu or the Chinese flu, was pretty strongly slapped down if you're on CBS, ABC, or anything else. Was there any kind of journalistic revolt to this type of censorship that you could detect?
I don't think there had, I was with Fox until 2018. I can't speak to what they do now. I don't think that they had too much of a problem with calling it the Wuhan flu or the Chinese virus until it just became so commonplace to call it COVID. In other newsrooms, I can't speak with first person authority, but I was stunned. I mean, I've been in this business for 45 years. I was stunned how the mainstream media rolled over and played dead once the World Health Organization said, don't, not Wuhan, call it COVID. COVID is a generic name. And it's not racist if you do that, because the Chinese would be very upset if you call it something like China. And these kinds of edicts went out from the World Health Organization, which has a master pet relationship with China.
You know, if I could go back for 1 second to rare earths,
yes.
We see China is actually owner, I believe 10% owner of one of the few firms in this country in Texas that produces rare earths. It's somewhat connected to Mountain Pass in California. We see the pharmaceutical that you just talked about. We see the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, where China is going and making loans to many developing nations that they can't afford. It's almost as if China has a shotgun approach at this point. There's not one part of the world they haven't touched. Do you think they have overextended themselves at this point, and that they're not as necessarily an imminent collapse of their economy, but they're going to get to a point where they're going to be struggling and there may be some internal domestic troubles for Xi Jinping?
It's an excellent question, Dari. I think they have overextended to the degree that they are everywhere right now, as you point out. I think that the headlines that we've seen about Evergrande and other Chinese companies are indicative of a shakiness in the Chinese economy. It may or may not be propped up by the Communist Party, which is the same as the government. That remains to be seen. Xi Jinping has given indications that he is not going to massively intervene to save Evergrande. And that would be one of the legs kicked out from the stool of communist control. Will there be internal struggles? I used to live in Moscow when it was part of the Soviet Union, and I'd come home and Americans would say to me, why don't the Russian people rebel against their government? And I said, you go first, you lead the charge and we'll follow. And it was like, well, not my country, but it was their country and it was the same problem. You go first. There is no toleration for dissent in China.
Yeah. We're speaking with John Rudy, author of a vitally important book, Of Course They Knew. You know, John, I do a number of interviews on other programs, and when the topic to be discussed has to do with COVID, frequently an engineer will come on and tell me, be sure you call it COVID. Don't use the Wuhan flu phrase. And of course, the first thing I do when the interview starts is I use the phrase Wuhan flu, thereby making myself very unpopular with that particular show. What is the overarching influence that China has had in our communications networks that prevents them from giving fair reporting about all this? You know, and you can extend it from there even to Hollywood. During the Cold War days, we saw a lot of spy films where the Soviets were always the bad guy. But in this new Cold War era with China, you don't see that. You don't see any TV detective shows or movies coming out with Chinese villains. It's just the opposite, actually. What is the stranglehold that China has so vehemently on the American media?
I think you're being very unfair, Frank. I don't think there are Chinese villains anywhere. look, I mean, you ask about how they affect the communications industry. Look at who the owners of the major outlets are. They're huge companies. They all want to do, have to do business with China. And when they make a movie or when they allow a report to be emitted that upsets the Chinese, there are consequences. Sometimes they're huge consequences. But you're absolutely right. There are no Chinese villains in movies that we see. There are only bad white men.
Yeah. Just before I go back to Daria, there was a remake of the popular film Red Dawn. And the original script called for a Chinese to invade the United States as opposed to the Soviet Union in the original. The script was changed from Prussia with China so that it was the North Koreans rather than the Chinese who invaded the United States. I'm sorry, Daria, go ahead.
No, I just sort of got excited when I heard that John had lived in Moscow. What I'm wondering is, how do you see great power conflict between Russia and China today moving forward? With the fall of Afghanistan, with the Chinese meeting with the Taliban in places like Tajikistan, the drug trade, the rare earths that are in eastern Afghanistan and the Wakhan Valley and different things, we see China having an interest for several reasons, to keep drugs out of China as well as to obtain rare earths and things. We see that Russia is challenged in Central Asia because of China moving in. Do you think that there is going to be some type of proxy war perhaps between Russia and China, maybe in Central Asia in the next decade?
Well, Daria, I think America has dreamed of a confrontation between Russia and China for well on 50 years now. Mao Zedong and Brezhnev never got around to it. Putin doesn't seem to be overly concerned with China, at least in terms of his own security. To your other point, drugs do get into China. They get in through the Xinjiang province, but not to a degree that it is, well, certainly not that it's reported, and certainly not to a degree that anybody is going to make it a top priority. China and Russia have different agendas, but they have one common interest, which is to destroy the United States.
We can probably write off the Biden administration doing anything useful regarding China or Russia, but assuming that Republicans get control of Congress or get control of the White House at some point, what steps should be taken, first of all, to go back and to expose what WHO did in covering up China, to expose what much of the media did in covering up Chinese implication in all the Chinese involvement in all this? Really, what steps should be taken?
It's an excellent question. I think it doesn't have an answer yet. A Republican-controlled Congress would have very limited power to uncover heretofore unknown aspects of the Chinese handling of COVID, and certainly of the media's coverage of it. I mean, there are First Amendment rights that would immediately come into play, and by the way, should. The last thing you want is China getting away with something because we're afraid to stand up for them. The even bigger thing you want to avoid is the media being afraid of what Congress might do to them. That's just not our style. So a Republican-controlled White House in 3 years or 2 years, or a Republican-controlled one or two houses of Congress, I think is not going to make a massive difference. Somebody in China that is not a fan of the Communist Party told me, as I was trying to do some research for this novel, and I admit this is a novel, this is fiction, but I was trying to do research and said to me, who do you think China really fears? And I, like you, Daria, I said, well, Russia, maybe? And he said, Russians are barbarians. No, we don't fear them. We fear Trump because he actually plays the way we do. He says something. If it's not right, he just doubles down on it. Daria, if you're a Chinese scholar, you know that there's a phrase in Chinese called Da Yang Wan, and which means the big lie. And, you know, China has been doing this for decades. They tell a lie, they get caught, and they say, no, it really is. And then they say it's even further. And the Chinese people use this in very, very restricted circumstances to talk about their party and their government. But everybody knows that they lie.
You know, one of the things that really concerns me is that the people are so repressed in China that there may not be a way for them to get in the next few decades to get out from under the extreme repression that the CCP has over the people. At the same time, we see population problems as they're becoming very negative, possibly even a decrease in their population. We see pollution problems, we see corruption problems within the society. It makes me wonder what is going to happen internally in that country. Will the leadership need to repress the people even further as social unrest arises? I think it's dangerous.
Yeah, well, I think what we're seeing now is the realization of Xi Jinping's dream. He calls it socialism with Chinese characteristics. Yeah. It's become it's undeniably affiliated with Xi Jinping. It's what he sees as the future. Now, what is the future? The future is enormous pollution in its industrial manufacturing sites, total party control over all aspects of life, repression of anyone who is not Han Chinese, the Han Chinese being the leading ethnic, the majority ethnic group in China. And look what they're doing to the Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang province. Mass extermination bordering on genocide. They may or may not succeed in shutting down all aspects of democracy in Hong Kong. They threaten Taiwan daily now with overflights into Taiwanese territory. It goes on and on, as you have said, it's a shotgun approach. No, the people aren't going to throw off their communist rulers. It's impossible. Yeah. I think that the idealism of many Americans is based on two thoughts. One, it's so far away and we can't figure it out and very few of us speak Chinese and what does it matter anyway? And the second is better them than Russia. Maybe.
I hate to sound pessimistic, but it seems that rather than China becoming more like us, aren't we becoming more like China? If you look at some of the steps the Biden administration has been taking.
Well, I saw just the other day that Joe wants to create his own Belt and Road program. I imagine that that's part of the Build Back Better initiative, but he's going to have a hard time selling it to a lot of countries.
Yeah, I think so. Tell us just a bit about the plot of the novel.
Plot of the novel. It's a novel. I made up the characters, four characters. One is an unhappy Chinese virologist, a woman. Another is an Italian master seamstress who had worked in Lombardy for many years, where, as you probably know, all of the major Italian clothing firms have their headquarters and their mills. In Lombardy, some of the companies were mismanaged and they were purchased by Chinese enterprises. Now, what China's business people do when they get into a foreign territory is they bring in thousands, tens of thousands of Chinese laborers who will make goods cheaper, faster, and without any complaints. And they did that with Italian clothing. There's a famous example of a brand name, which I won't mention, which had in the pockets of men's clothing and in the seams of women's clothing, made in Illati, not Italy, Illati. And millions of these things went out before they realized the people in the mills didn't know what they were sewing in there. Another character is, and everybody who has kids will think and worry, Daria, about this, a kid who got through Columbia University with honors and a master's degree and all that stuff. And the one thing he really learned on the campus of Columbia was that America is a terrible country. just terrible. It's racist, it's ineffective, it's wrong, it's you know, and he decided that the future is in China. So he went to China, Wuhan, by coincidence. And then there's a fourth character, main character in the book, who is a guy from Pittsburgh, which is my hometown, therefore I know it a little bit. And Pittsburghers just really don't like to be told what to do. I mean, we're just kind of we're a nasty bunch. And so he doesn't like what the government is telling him to do. He's not too sure about masks. He's not real sure about vaccinations. He is sure that he doesn't want to have to wear a mask that was made in China to keep him safe from a virus that was also made in China.
Unbelievable. John, it's been a fascinating conversation. Good luck with the book. How can our listeners get a copy of it?
Well, it's the usual suspects, and I'll go through them. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kindle, Nook. I do ask anybody who's interested in the book to please go to your local independent bookstore and ask them to stock it. We have to keep these stores alive. Otherwise, there won't be any other place to go.
Well said, John. Daria?
I would love to have you back on the show again to talk more. This was fascinating. Thank you.
We can worry together, Daria.
You know what? I actually am very hopeful about things in the future. You know, a lot of times we talk about the problems, but I think that we've had a lot of wake-up calls with Donald Trump, with COVID. I think the American people in general, they had their eyes opened. Hopefully they keep them open.
You know, Daria, one of the things I always say at the end is don't underestimate Americans. We may be lazy, we are not stupid.
Well, we're the best. We're the best, aren't we, Frank?
We are indeed. Thank you, John.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in.
We welcome our newest radio affiliate in Washington, D.C. at 96.7 FM. We're broadcast in Las Vegas, Nevada on 92.1 FM, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 1640 AM and 102.1 FM, Tampa, Florida, 92.1 FM, Ritchie, Florida, 88.3 FM, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 90.3 FM, Macon, Georgia, 810 AM and 98.3 FM, Boulder, Colorado, 100.7 FM, Long Beach, California, 101.5 FM, and in Pittsburgh at 107.3 FM. We're also available on the AMFM247.com, iHeart, Spreaker, and the Conservative Commandos. Tell Alexa to play the program. Tune into our television show, The American Political Zone, on the AUN Network, Roku, and Public Broadcast TV. You can access either program on our website at usagovpolicy.com. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week. We're sponsored by the New York Analysis of Policy and Government, a division of the American Analysis of News and Media, Inc. at usagovpolicy.com and the Institute for American Politics. Email us at truthinradio@gmail.com and tune into the American Political Zone television show, also on the AMFM247.com network.
Our producer is the amazing Abigail White, and our director is the brilliant Jeff Hansen.